Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl.
Hello.
You can say your last name better than I can.
Orzechowski.
We have a very packed show for you today. Before we jump into it, I should make an announcement on behalf of the folks that are putting together the Walk for Farm Animals, which is a benefit for farmed animals. That's happening on October 1st. They asked us to do an announcement. For more information about how you can get involved in the walk, you can dial 416-699-1107, or you can write to Julie or Holly at Toronto at walkforfarmanimals.org. Again, that's on October 1st, and it starts at 10:30. I think that there's kind of a process of going out and getting people to sponsor you, and then you do the walk, and then all that money goes towards a good cause. Today, we are speaking with three different people who are part of a collection of authors who contributed to a book called Igniting a Revolution: Voices in Defense of the Earth. And we're going to be speaking with Stephen Best, who is one of the editors of this very interesting text, as well as two other people who contributed. We're going to be speaking with Lisa Kemmerer. I'm sure I'm saying all these names wrong. And she wrote a really interesting piece called In the Beginning, God Created the Earth and Eco-Terrorism. It's a very interesting take on Christianity and what it has to offer radical politics, which is surprisingly a lot. And we are also going to be speaking with a very interesting gentleman named Maxwell, and I'm going to leave it up to him to say his last name. His essay here is about looking at and trying to find out why people get involved with militant direct action. He does a comparative study in the book for Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. But without further ado, are we going to try to? We have on Stephen Best. So, Stephen, thank you for being here today.
Hi, great to be with you again.
Yeah, it's always a real honor to have you on the program. You also run your own radio show as well.
Oh, yes, we do. It's Animal Concerns of Texas, and it's online at ktet.org. We have some archives there as well as on my website, drstevebest.org.
Great. And you're currently an associate professor of humanities and philosophy at the University of Texas in El Paso. And you teach, it says here in your bio, lots of different subjects: modern humanities, critical thinking, ethics, social philosophy, 19th and 20th century philosophy, animal rights, environmental theory, postmodern theory, and philosophy of science and technology. It's sometimes very difficult to know where to start for introducing you. So we want to welcome you to the program today, and we'd like you to give us an overview of Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth, this new text. I think that this will definitely shake up some different communities, hopefully get people talking a bit more about these topics. In the introduction, you both talk about revolutionary environmentalism, and you differentiate it from radical environmentalism. Maybe that's a good place to start with the book, talking about what is revolutionary environmentalism and what were some of the topics that you wanted to cover in this book and why.
Well, thanks. It's the second book that Tony and I have done. First one, of course, was Terrorists or Freedom Fighters, Reflections on the Liberation of Animals. And we published that 2004 in Lancet Books. And this one is with AK Press, which we're very happy to be a part of. It follows the same strategy and philosophy as the first book on Terrorists or Freedom Fighters, in that we seek to define a space for radical politics that is still very open, still very fluid, and not very well pinned down yet, insofar as these politics turn on what I call the politics of nature, whereas I think the most dynamic and radical potential movements today are the animal rights and environmental movements. And so building on Terrorists of Freedom Fighters, what we do is we look at various issues around the politics of nature from different perspectives. We include a lot of different voices. There's a lot of diversity and plurality in both books. So in both books, you'll find contributions from feminists and academics, from political prisoners and activists, from people of color, and just about the whole spectrum: Native Americans, Black liberationists, etc. So once again, we try to solicit a wide variety of critical perspectives. I, at to emphasize critical because these are all radical voices in their own way. But I have to say we've outdone ourselves a little bit because this new volume has over 40-some contributions. And it was a lot to edit and do, and we weren't sure it all fit together in one volume that you could fit in a backpack. But it did come together quite nicely. It is a manageable volume in size and cost. We are calling this revolutionary environmentalism. Sometimes people call it radical environmentalism. But radical environmentalism kind of has always had the connotation of being a little bit academic or maybe a little bit not fully supportive or engaging the full spectrum of tactics that are available. And so we hope it's more than just semantics, but revolutionary environmentalism, that's what we're defining it. Certainly would include things like deep ecology, social ecology, ecofeminism, black liberation, Native American, environmental justice movements, and animal liberation, sure. But it's also going to suggest that any and all tactics are on the table. Any and all tactics are important and necessary in these times of corporate fascism. And so that would include the tactic for armed struggle and violence if necessary. And I think these are dire times. I think that the tactics of moderation are now immoderate. I think that so-called extreme tactics are barely just reaching the level of the kind of forms of struggle that we need to begin mounting against this global transnational corporate system.
We had on the show a little while ago Lee Hall, who just wrote a book called Capers in the Churchyard, and I'm sure you've heard about this book by now. And she comes out quite strongly against this type of, or I mean, this is so broadly defined really in this book, it's really even difficult to pin it down to one category. But Hall comes out quite strongly against most of what I would assume is in this book because of it being, she links it to kind of a hyper-masculine, masculinity, a kind of call to war, that these discourses themselves kind of work against the ultimate objective of what she's speaking about, in particular the animal liberation movements, the animal rights movement, which is this goal of peace and nonviolence. And she says you can't, you know, arrive there with violent tactics.
Well, I listened to that interview, and with all due respect to Lee, because I think she's doing some good work holding down the animal rights versus welfare position. Oh, I think she's way off base, and I listened carefully for an argument, and I never heard one from her. You know, it seems like people are still struggling with these pacifist peacenik visions of the 1960s, and one of my favorite quotes that I included in Terrorists of Freedom Fighters is from Bite Back magazine, to the effect that the 60s are over, and animals don't have time for your hippie dreams. So, you know, this is a struggle, this is a war, okay? And in conditions of war, I'm not so sure that Gandhi is more relevant than Machiavelli. And if they're using Machiavellian tactics, and we're using Gandhian tactics, if they're using violence, you know, we're committed to nonviolence, and we think that, oh, well, nonviolence and love will ultimately win the day, these are the kinds of positions that oppressors want us to believe. I'm sure they're quite handy. They're quite happy that we hold these positions. In fact, I'm surprised they don't buy free copies of Martin Luther King and Gandhi for all of us to have and read. These tactics work to an effect, and I think we definitely ought to pursue education legislation to the extent that they're possible. But, I mean, look, this is the era of George Bush, the so-called war on terror. And if there was ever a time to be skeptical that legalist tactics will work, that we can bring animal rights or radical social changes in and through the legal system and in and through the legal system only, I think this is a serious delusion. We have to be very careful what tactics we use. We have to have careful analysis and debate about what tactics are helpful and when they're necessary. And if we use sabotage or certainly anything beyond that, these tactics have to be done with a high amount of intelligence and sensitivity and good media work to follow up these tactics. But I think that direct action, sabotage, and, you know, in some parts of the world, certainly armed struggle, like indigenous tribes in the rainforest, they're using armed struggle. And I think it's actually quite a Western-centric perspective to universally bar armed struggle and sabotage as you know and promote these ethics of nonviolence. It's quite pretentious to make these universal declarations, where in some parts of the world these are the only tactics that have a chance of working. And I'm glad you brought up this point of that direct action sabotage, that these are masculist movements. There is an author in the book, Igniting Revolution, Marty Keel, a well-known ecofeminist, that makes this argument. And she makes it as well as possible, I think. There's some truth to it, and I think it's worth reading and considering carefully. But it's also very interesting to note that some of the strongest arguments for direct action, deed violence, in the book come from feminists, mm-hmm. come from women. And these would include Marilyn Buck, who was a political prisoner, and Patrice Jones, a well-known radical feminist. And there are other voices. Anne Hansen, mm-hmm. Who in fact is still doing time for bombing pornography shops that firebombing them for running particularly virulent kinds of violent pornography against women. So I'd like to know how Lee Hall or some other of these critics would like to hold up this position that these are masculist visions. I mean, they would have to say that these women are very politically astute, are somehow under the influence of sexist values. And I don't think it really, ultimately, is about whether these are male or female visions of politics, but whether these are effective or ineffective.
We had Josh Harper on a while ago, and I was looking through our archive, and we've also spoken with Kevin Jonas as well. And, of course, this is me looking over our archives post the sentences given out to the Shack 7, and I thought that it's an interesting time to be doing an interview about radical politics, revolutionary environmentalism in the wake of what's happened with those activists. When we had Josh Harper on, he said, you know, I'm so glad you're having me on the radio because I'm actually not allowed into your country. And one of the things that, you know, I hope that community radio can offer and I hope books like this can offer is at the very least, regardless of where you stand on these positions, there must be some way that we are allowed to dialogue about them and to continue to dialogue.
Exactly. Any and all tactics have to be on the table. They have to be discussed. And if they're effective, they have to be used. I mean, look, I'm about liberating the earth and the animals. I'm not about dogmas. I'm not about, upholding principles just because someone like Gandhi or King said that these are the best. Ironically, by the way, now that I think of it, those were two males upholding these positions of nonviolence. So there's your masculinist ideologies for you. But we need a revolutionary movement on this planet, and it's time to start thinking a little bit past, a little bit outside the box. And one of the contributions I hope that Terrorists and Freedom Fighters made, and this book builds on, is think about direct action and radical politics more carefully, because I don't think a lot of people that are critical of direct action know really what it's about, nor do they know very well the history of social movements. I defy anyone to find me a social movement that has broken through one form of domination or another that didn't have a radical element to it, indeed sometimes a violent element. And when I listen to someone like Lee Hall, or you read the latest book by Joan Dunyer, which I criticized, and you can find that review on my website, I find it interesting that they call themselves abolitionists, but that they entirely separate their 21st century animal rights abolitionist visions from the tradition of the 19th century for the abolition of human slavery. And when you look at that movement, these people weren't fooling around. And you had your John Browns and Nat Turners of the movement who used armed struggle and used violence. You had people like Frederick Douglass, you know, who actually supported some of these they didn't support violence themselves, but supported, or didn't use violent tactics, but supported violent struggles, like they supported the struggles of John Brown. So, you know, that movement used any and all tactics that was necessary to win the abolition of slavery. And even where there was a violent revolution that was quelled or defeated, that helped to inspire further actions, legal and illegal, violent and nonviolent. That helped keep the movement alive. And so, you know, look, if we're going to call our positions abolitionist, let's realize that the abolitionist movement that we all are modeling ourselves after used indeed any and all tactics to win the day.
There's an article in the book by, I believe, Craig Marshall, where he talks about, speaking of tactics and effective tactics, he talks about being in jail for torching SUVs. And he reflects on that in a rather negative way and sort of, and says that it's essentially not enough. Could you sort of speak to that article and right. about the actual diversity of tactics that you're talking about?
Right. He's absolutely right. There's some other positions in this book that say that sabotage is not enough. Look, sabotage is a rear guard action. We're not going to win a revolution through sabotage. I mean, we're throwing literally right monkey wrenches into the machine. That's where the term came from, the 19th century tactic of throwing monkey wrenches into the machine to slow down the process of exploitation. And nobody ever thought that it was going to end it. You need a social movement to do that. So one of the key things about revolutionary environmentalism as a concept of relating to this book is that the politics of the day can no longer be a welfarist. It can no longer be abolitionist in Lee Hall's legalist sense. Certainly it will be abolitionist. And it can no longer be single-issue politics of any kind. Mm-hmm. It has to be alliance politics. We have to build bridges across different kinds of movements. The animal liberation movement has to build bridges with the black liberation movement, with the Native Americans, and vice versa, I think, because we're all in this together. And I have a concept that I call total liberation. Not earth liberation, not animal liberation, not human liberation, but total liberation, and they all will stand or fall together. Now, on this note, I just came back from a two-week speaking tour of South Africa, and I was amazed by how concrete it is to realize that human liberation and animal liberation, the human interest and animal interest, really are tied together. If you go into South Africa or anywhere in Africa, you start talking about animal rights, divorced from human rights, you're going to get a machete to the back of your head, I think, because the suffering on this on that continent is just so obscene, it's so outrageous, that no one is going to listen to you unless you address those concerns, especially if you're someone like me, white, Western, middle-class male. But these issues are so obviously tied together in South Africa. For instance, I saw whole communities displaced and pushed to the margins in Soweto. And these animals don't follow these people. These people certainly can't afford to take care of their animals. So if we care about animals, we have to go in and we have to help these people with their poverty and their homelessness. If we want to give animals homes, we have to give people's homes. There's a lot of debate about culling elephants, killing elephants, massacring elephants, and whole black communities are often in favor of killing an elephant. An elephant can be $10,000 or $20,000. It can be a community center to them. And of course, this is entirely wrong. I don't care what the logical rationale is. But obviously, they're talking about culling and killing elephants, who are allegedly overpopulating places like Kruger National Park, because these people are poor. We want to stop elephant culling. They're about to start culling elephants at Kruger National Park again in South Africa. We have to address the issue of poverty. We have to go in with some real proposals. We have to go into these communities and help these people if we want to help animals. So this is part of what I mean by total liberation. So we have to really start addressing this. And the animal rights movement, the environmental movement, has done very little work to this effect. And terrorists or freedom fighters, as well as igniting a revolution, should be seen, I think, ideally, not just as theories or calls for these things, but as actual instances of doing them. Because we have brought together a lot of different people under one rubric, and it's not easy to do that.
Steve, we're going to have to cut you off there because we're going to go and talk with Maxwell now. I want to say thanks for being on the show.
Max and Elisa are two of the great contributions to the book, and I'm sure they'll flesh it out further. And I really appreciate your interview. And again, the book is Igniting Revolutions, available through AK Press.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you. Take care. keep up the great work.
Thanks very much. We're just speaking with Steve Best. He's one of the editors for this book, as he mentioned, Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. We're going to be speaking with Maxwell Scherner, and he wrote an article called They Took Ulrich Meinhof's Brain, A Comparative Study of the Causes of and Justifications for Militant Direct Action. I'd like to take a short little musical break, come back with Max, as Steve calls him, and we'll go from there. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, co-hosting with us today, Lamia Teking. At the beginning of the program, we were speaking with Dr. Stephen Best. He is one of the editors for the book, Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth, that we're talking about today. Unfortunately, we can't get Maxwell on the line. I'm hoping he'll give us a shout back. And so we're going to switch now to our interview with Lisa Kammerer, and wanted to talk about her contribution in the book, Igniting a Revolution. There is a chapter here called In the Beginning, God Created the Earth and Ecoterrorism. Lisa, thanks for being on the show today.
You're welcome.
It's a real pleasure. We had some organizing trials, and I was so pleased that people were able to be on the program at the same time, so I wanted to give you a very warm welcome. I'll do a little bit of an introduction for you. You have a BA from Reed College. You have a Master's in Comparative Religions from Harvard Divinity School, PhD in Philosophy from the University of Glasgow, and you've taught philosophy and religions in Alaska. Is that right? Alaska, mm-hmm. Washington, and Scotland. And I'm very excited to read your book called In Search of Consistency, Ethics, and Animals. And you describe yourself as an activist, a traveler, an adventurer. So thanks, Lisa, again for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell us about why you got involved and wanted to make a contribution to Igniting a Revolution and what you ended up contributing.
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess I would have worded it differently. I'm involved with an interest in the earth and animals, and so it's a natural when something comes along where you can do something with that, that you want a chance to have your voice heard and to help in whatever way you can.
Mm-hmm.
So I was privileged to be invited to contribute something by Steve and Tony, and I was very excited about the possibility. And so often in liberal circles, and certainly in movements like the Liberation Front, Christianity tends to be not a prominent part for whatever reason. And so I felt that it was important to have something in there that deals with the predominant strain of religion in our society.
And so what, I mean, it's a really interesting article. You talk about how there is within scripture, biblical scripture, this call for action, and that you look at, you know, at least the first few chapters, Genesis, that the sort of the sentiments, the philosophies, the motivations behind a lot of the more radical or revolutionary environmentalism are already embedded within those scriptures. Can you explain that a bit more?
Fascinating to know that when you look at what Christianity has become in our culture.
Mm.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is somewhat, it was startling for me to start doing reading and to research and look closely at the Bible and realize that right here in what has become mainstream America, the part that is, if anything, holding systems in place that are hurting animals and the earth, is the seeds of something that should bring change and initially did. But when a religion becomes mainstream, it often sells out on its highest principles, but they are, of course, still written in the scripture. What do you want me to say more about? Do you want me to talk about the scripture more?
Well, I'm just imagining for people tuning in saying, what do you mean? How does this have anything to do with eco-terrorism? Right. What do you mean call for action?
Yeah,
give
fact,
us some specifics.
It is the sad truth that one wonders, what could scripture, what could conventional Christianity have to do with helping the earth? It's a sad truth that the two have become so divided. Well, if you look at scripture closely, now, scripture, of course, is the root of Christianity. It is what Christians base their beliefs on. It is the most foundational part. Now, they can say it's a relationship, but the relationship, you have to have information to get that, and scripture is where you get the relationship with the divine. So if you look at scripture closely, and Genesis, the reason Genesis is very important is it's the only place in the Bible where we see what God really wanted. The divine created a world that was peaceful, where everything was respected, where everything was considered good and everything was God's. It's a foundational idea that is not lived out by Christians in our world. They even speak as if the world were given to them to do what they want with. In my article, I look at some of the key ideas, like being made in the image of God or having dominion, ideas that have been critical to the destruction of the earth and to the exploitation of other creatures, and looking at what those terms really mean, looking at the fact that God created in 6 days, on the sixth day, all creatures were created together. And every day God says that it's good. God doesn't wait for human beings to come around to say, oh, now we have a good earth. But everything is good. Everything that God creates is good. And then we are made in the image of God. Well, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean we're going to manifest in burning bushes? Does that mean that God's a primate? Well, not likely. You know, what it means is that we're supposed to be godlike in our nature, in our characteristics. So being made in the image of God is different than what I recently, just this last summer, I had a Christian say to me, we are God's favorite. And I just thought, how can you say that? How can you believe in a God that would create all these sentient beings on this beautiful earth and favor one creature, one minuscule portion of it? But that's what he believed. And of course, in the article, I also go into the idea that in the image of, if you look historically, the region that this idea came from, in the image of meant that kings were supposed to rule in the image of God, and it was a way of standing in God's stead. So if you look historically where the word comes from, it means that we are given to run this world as God would if God were the king instead of human beings running their own political systems and making their own decisions for the earth and animals. But we, of course, don't do that. And then I look at dominion, the other catchphrase. Dominion is indeed given to human beings, a vegan dominion, one where we cannot eat the other creatures. So what does that mean if you're given a dominion in which you cannot harm or exploit the other creatures? And we're not even given dominion over the earth itself, over the waters, over the air. We're given dominion over everything that moves across the face of the earth. So that's only the other creatures, and we can't eat them. What a different view of dominion from that most of us have.
Tell us about why there was this shift. If some of these principles are in the scripture as you outline them, what happened? How do you trace that history? How did they become, in a way, almost exactly the opposite of what they were purporting to do in the first place? I mean, especially with something like dominion, this is often used by people to mean domination.
Well, that's a fascinating question. How do you explain how people could so twist something that could be so good? Was it too hard to live up to that reality? Was it pure selfishness? Was it arrogance? You know, there's no explaining, and you can look back on, I can tell you one historic reason. If you look back on the writings of some of the fathers of the church way back in the Catholic days, you can see where those early writers got their ideas straight out of Greek thinking, and they simply added God. The Greek thinkers taught, Aristotle taught, that everything has a purpose. And so the grass is here for the animals to eat, and the animals are here for us to eat. You can see those words simply rewritten, that God made everything with a purpose in Christian doctrine. So, you know, it's not coming out of Christianity itself. It's not coming from a close look at Scripture. It's coming from the Greek tradition earlier on, pre-Christian.
I think it's interesting that you point to Jesus, and you talk about the prophets, too, as not necessarily, I guess, most people would not associate the prophets with any kind of violence or any kind of upheaval, but you point to a slightly different history, a different reading.
Mm-hmm. Looking at these characters, how they're presented in the Bible rather than how they've come down to be presented, it's the same as looking at the word dominion. When little children in Bible school learn about dominion, they learn that God gave us the animals to eat them. When little children in Bible school learn about Jesus or the prophets, they learn about the vision that was handed down rather than what is actually written there. The prophets were outrageous. Jesus was annoying. I mean, that's why they strung him up. He was trying to change the system, and those in power never liked someone who comes along and says, you know, maybe we should change things a little bit. The ones in power had a pretty good situation going on, and they weren't interested in his new teaching, so they removed him. That's the brass tacks of Jesus' life. He wasn't a mamby-pamby-go-along-with-the-system sort of a guy.
You have this great quote. This is on page 166 in the conclusion here, and you said, toward this end, Christians have at their disposal outrageous acts pioneered by the prophets and violence against property, a violence that risks no life, modeled by Jesus.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's really interesting.
It makes me happy to know it's in there. Yeah, when you look at Jesus as a person who was taking a stand against conventions. And if you look at the Bible, you can see where he's offering a new teaching and a new way of living. And Christians, if they're really going to live up to what their tradition has offered them, it isn't just a simple life. It's a life of dedication. It's a life of service. It's a life of love. And how many Christians do you know that devote their lives to those ideas? Very few. Most of them go about, you know, driving their SUVs and bringing home their incomes and eating whatever they're eating, flesh, doing things that are very hurtful that they could easily choose, make other choices, and which Scripture suggests they should. They should be like those prophets. They should join PETA in the naked marchers, like the prophets who went naked. And the society thought that they were outrageous. But on the other hand, what is outrageous is often the way things ought to be. What is mundane is often simply what is easiest and what those in power want.
And you really talk about it as being a moral imperative. This isn't just something that Christians should do if they have time, that if you're going to ascribe to this particular religion, that there's a kind of radical, compassionate ethic that calls people forward, that they must do this.
Absolutely so. I'm working on a new book now. It's called Real Christians Don't Eat Meat. And it is what is written, that real Christians, in fact, do not cause harm and suffering when they don't need to. And they don't need to. So, yes, it is absolutely an imperative to recognize that God created an earth, that God said the earth was good, that this earth is God's, and that anything we're doing that hurts this earth is therefore inimical to the divine. And to be a Christian devoted to God, well, then how do you live? Do you live a life that is easy and simple and goes along with a society like ours? Where you do live, you choose a different life that shows respect and love for the world.
So how have, you know, you mentioned one of the Christians that you've spoken to, I think you said this past summer, that said, you know, we're God's favorite. How have people been responding to this text or this type of reading that you present?
Well, I think the most important thing is that no one can say to me, you're wrong. They end up with having a choice. They can either say, you're wrong, God really isn't loving, God is okay with all this suffering and destruction that we're doing for selfish reasons, for material reasons that have nothing to do with the fundamental teachings of Jesus. Or they can say, you're right, God is loving, God does care about this beautiful earth, God did create a wonderful earth, and we are supposed to take care of it. You know, it's a no-brainer. But then they're in the position where they look at their lives and they recognize that they're not living up to their religion, even though many of them are. I mean, they would say that they believe they're amongst those who they say are good Christians, as opposed to all those they look at and think are not good Christians.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you pointed to this at the beginning of our interview, that so often Christianity gets kind of paired with more kind of conservative or even right-wing kind of sentiment, certainly in the United States, and I think that's probably true in Canada as well. It's so interesting to think Christianity could be part of the fuel for addressing the violence against the earth as being something that could be a bit of a healer rather than a harmer.
Mm-hmm. And you're right, it has not been. I think especially in the United States, the mainstream uses Christianity like President Bush does. I don't think the man would look no evil if he looked in the mirror. It's just he talks about Scripture, he talks about sin, he talks about... He shows that he's a Christian, but he absolutely does not show it in his life. He doesn't show it by living a Christ-like life. And that is what Christians are ultimately called to. Does Bush live a Christ-like life? Well, how many of the people in power really do? The trick, of course, is getting, at an individual level, I talk to people and have success in getting them to agree that what I say is, in fact, true to Scripture. It is true to Christianity. Getting that into the churches is a different matter. Mm-hmm. Here is the whole problem with the mainstream religion. The churches need people in the pews. If they get up there and say, well, now it's time for you to start riding your bicycles and stop eating flesh, no one's going to show up next Sunday. And they're not going to have any money, and the church is going to go under. So when you have an institution, I mean, as a teacher, I know this. We have to do these evaluations where either people like you or you don't. So do you be a hardline teacher, or do you get good reviews from your students? So do you be the kind of preacher who really teaches what Jesus taught, or do you fill the church with happy, happy, quasi Christians?
How do you see that shift then from a let's say a mainstream Christianity towards a more radical Christianity that embodies the things that you're speaking about?
How do I envision it happening?
Yeah, or just, you know, if a preacher was to do that and sort of go against that grain, what do you think would happen, really?
Well, there have been a few that have. Mm-hmm. Andrew Lindsay, Mark Wessels, I think is his last name, if I'm pronouncing it right, and they just have very small churches, or very small following, where they become scholars. If a person in a pulpit suddenly comes onto this new information, realizes it's true, and is sincere enough about their faith to want to change, how are they going to bring the whole congregation along with them? Realistically, change happens from inside, and it happens slowly, and it happens based on personal experience. So a preacher can be part of that by offering a message. But realistically, you're going to empty the pews if you go back to what Jesus really taught and insist on it in almost any church in either of our countries. Those churches will probably become just about empty of people. So I'm not sure. You know, I'm an educator. So for me, you touch people where and when you can to get them to rethink how they're living and what the basis of their values and their morals are. But I'm not sure it's something that others can cause to happen. It has to be internal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so for seeing long-term deep change in this country, nothing happens fast. And, you know, the problems are so huge. If you look at what's behind it, if you look at capitalism, if you look at the corporations, the big industries that are motivating what's going on, in a country of capitalism where the dollar speaks and people don't tend to be reflective but rather materialistic, you know, that you look, the more you crawl back up the ladder of problems, the larger and more insurmountable they see. Nonetheless, obviously, I still have hope. I continue to work in the field, and that's why I work in the area of Christianity. It is the leading religion in our countries. So if you can get a few sincere Christians to read this material and recognize it, and they can touch a few, I think it's the grassroots. It's at that level of individual to individual that there is hope for change.
Lisa, we're not able to reach Maxwell, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to stay with us to the end of the program, and if we've opened up the discussion a little bit more to talk about some of your other work, and as well as your book, In Search of Consistency, Ethics and Animals. Are you up for a more extended interview?
I would be happy to. Yeah, I should feel sorry about Maxwell.
Well, we'll get him on definitely at some point.
I'm sure he's excited as I was.
Yeah, he seemed very enthusiastic. So we'd love to have him on the show. But as I was reading more about you and Maxwell, I thought, wow, I really need to get both of these people back on the show to talk about their work outside of this book as well. And I had heard about In Search of Consistency, Ethics and Animals, and a lot of my friends and I have been kind of knocking our heads against the wall for a long time with that very question, what would be consistent? What is consistency in our ethics? What does that look like? So maybe we could start there to hear more about that book and maybe some of your background about what brought you to look at these questions.
Okay, which would you like first?
Well, let's go. Actually, it probably makes sense to hear more of your background, and then we'll go into the book.
All right. To some extent, I'm a firm believer that I don't matter at all. It's the ideas that matter. And I usually resist answering too many questions about who I am because I don't want that to taint the actual ideas. But in as much as it's relevant, things that won't taint the ideas, where I came to the earth and the animal and caring about the liberation movement, you know, it's hard to say when you look back on your past, but I know my father was a very gentle person, and my mother cared very much about life. I grew up in the country and had animals all around us, frogs and birds, and as kids we did our share of damage, and I remember my father saying, leave them alone. You know, do they like what you're doing to them? Having a sense that they were also persons, individuals with wants and desires, was a fairly unique thing for a child to get from their parent, and he was out and watched us often running around in the woods and kind of kept an eye on us. So from that, I learned to care about animals. We ate meat. We killed our own chickens. And I remember watching my father butcher chickens, and I know he hated it. I know my father. He hated killing things, but he didn't question it. He grew up on a very, very poor farm in eastern Washington where without the things that they'd had, they wouldn't have made it. They barely made it as it was. So questioning that for him, he hated it, but he did it. But at some point, my sister sent me a flyer from, it was from PETA. It was their downer cows. And I just decided I was done with that, that I didn't have to be part of that, and that part of me had that sensitivity, that openness was already there. And so I became a vegetarian, and about a decade later, I learned that I wasn't doing the creatures of the earth any favors by switching to dairy and eggs. So out they went, and I became a vegan, and I've been a vegan for about a decade, and it all comes from recognizing that I have a choice about how I live, I am responsible for what I do, and if I have a choice whether to cause more suffering or less suffering, I absolutely must choose to cause less suffering.
And you've really been focused in your academic life on philosophy and religion. Why are you drawn towards those fields in particular in terms of some of these issues, or is it outside of considering some of those things that we've been talking? I'm curious about how your academic life has run along the other concerns that you've had.
Well, it's a good question. And I came to academics through my caring for the earth and animals. It is why I am an academic. I didn't grow up thinking I would become an academic. I grew up caring about the earth and animals and started finding out how I was going to make that part of my life a real part of my life. And the only reason I got a doctorate was because I loved teaching, and I knew teaching was a great way to mix with people, to talk about ideas and to bring new ideas to people. And because I knew I wanted to go into the area of animals and ethics, I had a subject I wanted to work with. So for me, it wasn't like, okay, I want a doctorate, what should I do? It was a matter of, I want to change how the earth and animals are treated, so I will get a doctorate, and I will do what I can with that.
Hmm. And why religion in particular? Why have you been drawn to study that?
Religions are just so important. And I've done a lot of traveling. And when I was overseas, I kept bumping into people who were religious, there was just religious violence. When I was in Ladakh, there was a dispute between the Buddhists and the Muslims, and there was tear gas and a lockdown, and we weren't allowed out of our motels. And so finally, after several days, we would go out. We'd sneak out and run around and see the tear gas, and one guy lifted his baton to smack one of my friends. And then we started babbling in our own language, and they realized that he had dark hair, but he was absolutely not the country. And they said, go back to your motel room. What are you doing out here? And so I had this sense that, well, and it goes on. There was a stabbing when I was in the Holy Land, watching the anger, the petty disputes going on just because it was the Holy Land, how it being the Holy Land created this land of strife. Tiananmen Square happened just after I left China and was in Hong Kong, and people standing up against this mammoth institution. So I was seeing these things in my travels that made me think religion is a key. The way we believe and what we do, it can either be a really good thing or a really bad thing. And if people only understood, I think, the deepest teaching, it would become a really good thing. And I thought to myself, in dealing with people, when I bump into them, I ran into this born-again Christian. He hated misogynist scientists. He didn't care about anything but science. He was appalling, but he spoke English. So we spent like a month together. We were so excited to be able to. We were both very interested in ideas, arguing and talking and discussing, and I thought, had I bumped into someone who was an atheist, then they could simply say, I don't care. But when you're dealing with someone who has a religious background, and you say to them, here's what your religion teaches, here's what you are standing behind when you say you are X, Y, or Z, or whatever they happen to be, they can't say, I don't care. They have to care. And to me, that makes all the difference.
I want to spend our last few minutes talking about In Search of Consistency, Ethics and Animals, a book that's newly published. Can you tell us about that book and some of the questions that you explore in it?
I sure can. I noticed in my explorations of the subject that there is no one book that covers deeply some of the most important ideas. So the book takes four of the most important thinkers. It takes, obviously, Regan and Singer, so I have a utilitarian and a rights theorist. Completely different ways of approaching animal rights. I shouldn't even say animal rights. Animal liberation, because Singer isn't for rights. He doesn't talk about rights. Rights aren't what he deals with. He's a utilitarian. Then I added to that Andrew Lindsay, a theologian, talking about scripture and faith and how those affect our treatment of animals. And finally, an environmentalist, Paul Taylor, who writes about respect for nature and how respect for nature will change how we treat individual animals. So unlike most scientists, he's not a holist. He doesn't talk about ecosystems solely. He also talks about individuals within the system. So these four thinkers, I present their theories, I critique their theories, and show what's wrong with their theories, and I try to do it very respectfully. I mean, these people have done tremendous work, and it's very important to me that I not be dismissive or disrespectful in my work, in talking about their work. They're great thinkers. And then, when I'm all done with that, I look at world religions, and I explore how Lindsay, the theologian's work, is really just an extension of what every religion teaches. And how can you have a religion that says, go ahead and kill and maim and cause suffering, right? It's kind of a no-brainer. So then I go in and explore four or five other main religions, Islam, indigenous, Chinese, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and look at some of their teachings and how they also insist that their followers be sensitive and respectful towards all life. And then, at the end of the book, I get to look very closely at this idea of consistency. I look at our human ethic of life, and I say, well, here's what we do for anencephalic infants, for instance, babies without brains. Here's how we treat them. So here's a stand we take with regard to, say, something like abortion. Now, how do you make that, based on the fact that we have no morally relevant distinction between all human beings and all other creatures, philosophic consistency requires us to apply those across species boundaries. So I basically look at what that would mean. I look at issues to first develop a sense of what that ethic is, and then I start to apply it across boundaries. And ultimately, I question the ethic itself.
It sounds like an interesting book.
Oh, it was gigantic. It was a huge life process. I lost my head. I got so involved in the ideas. I just kept working and working, and it's a mammoth.
What are your new directions now? I mean, this book is just completed. I'm assuming that you're going to be kind of in the wake of that for a while. We'd love to have you back on to talk more about it. But where are you heading now in terms of some of the things that you'd like to explore further?
Well, I haven't even seen this book yet. I haven't got a copy yet. And yet, last summer I began writing. As I say, I'm working on Real Christians Don't Eat Meat. And from now on, this book was a very scholarly book and very important to me. That if classrooms want to use a book that covers the philosophical basis, they're all, the most important ones are kind of covered in there. The next books I want to work on are more going to be more of a combination of, I don't know if you know that, there's like Scully and Phelps or Scully and Lindsay, so that they're books that look carefully at scripture, but in a way that is more like Scully does, pulling and compelling with real life examples and working with that gut sense of what's right as well as what scripture says. And that's the book I'm working on now, and I'm very excited about it. If I could have chosen all along a book I want to write, although the last one also is one that I've sensed was needed. There's little thin books that barely touch on, but having a really substantial book that talks about the liberation movement and what's behind it philosophically, as well as looking closely at scripture and the issue of how we treat other creatures, those are the areas that I work in and the areas that I more or less want to continue working in. One never knows what I'm going to do.
We only have a couple more minutes left. I wanted to turn it over to you if you had any last thoughts that you wanted to share with our listeners.
Yes, I guess I do. I first want to thank Tony and Steve and both of you for putting this together and for having a show called Animal Voices. And I want to encourage listeners to think about life and what really matters, that when you wake up in the morning and you look at the day and you look at what you are and what you aren't, that you are a life on this planet that has a choice for that day, but that ultimately you will be gone. You'll be gone in the snap of a finger. That your life is very short. And to ask yourself how you really want to live and what really matters to you, and in the long run, what kind of a legacy you're going to leave.
Lisa, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much,
both of you.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
I look forward to reading it. And,
thank you so much.
And my students, I'm teaching a class right now at York University, and my students were asking about some of the religious views, because the course is very secular. We look at, we've been just talking about Regan and Singer and weighing into that debate and looking at social contract theories and all these different things. And there's a real desire, though, within the class. We move into looking at how the animal movements intersect with other social justice movements, but there is a gap. gap in terms of what we're looking at for religion. So I will direct them to your book, and of course I'd like to look more at Andrew Lindsay as well and include some of his readings as well. So it's a good reminder for me.
Thank you. I hope it's of use, and if you or your readers have suggestions or comments, please send them my way as it helps build better books in the future.
Sure. Do you want to give an email address, or is there a way that people can contact you, or would you just like to?
Okay. Absolutely. My email is my first initial and my last name, so LKEMMERER at msubillings.edu.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Have a great day.
And you too.
Bye. We were just speaking with Lisa, and she wrote an article for the Igniting a Revolution book we're speaking about today. This article is called In the Beginning, God Created the Earth and Ecoterrorism. Very fascinating read. That's Lisa Kemmerer, and we're going to try to get Maxwell on in a later program, hopefully sometime soon. Maybe I'll do a pre-recorded show, and then we'll put it up on the Internet if we don't get him on live. I wanted to thank Lamia for teching Carl for coming in, and please stay tuned for Roadrunner. You're listening to CIUT 89.5. 5.